Hello, everybody out there. This is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, which comes to you these days. The new sort of autumn schedule is basically most Wednesdays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in Belfast. And it goes out live as a live stream broadcast on the Facebook pages of KABU Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon, and the Facebook page of Popular Resistance, and then also on my Facebook and YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, VK, LinkedIn. And then it gets turned into a podcast afterwards. If you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform, and I put it up on SoundCloud and Patreon and elsewhere as a podcast as well. And special broadcasts coming up include tomorrow I'll be live streaming on my own platforms, not on KABU or Popular Resistance, but on my own platforms tomorrow all day, basically all afternoon. I'll be at Big Red Studio outside of Portland live streaming a recording session. And then Sunday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. in London, I'll be doing a concert online for the New York City Anarchist Book Fair, which is a virtual event which is taking place all weekend at, anarchistbookfair.net, I believe. And today, I'm very happy to have with me for the hour Ellie Arbor, a fantastic hip-hop artist from Rochester, New York, Austin, Texas via Rochester, or Rochester via Austin. And with no further ado, I'm just going to introduce everybody out there to Ellie Arbor. Wonderful. And Ellie, great to have you back. We spoke briefly for a Fifth Estate Live program a few weeks ago, which is every Tuesday morning, I should have mentioned when I was introing everything. But it's been a bit of an eternity since then, between then and now in Rochester. There's a lot to talk about, but you happen to be right now in one of the sort of centers of activity, along with Louisville these days Portland and various other certain cities across the country. Exactly.
I
find with cities like Rochester these days, it's like it's in and out of national headlines, but mostly out and occasionally in. And when it's out, there's a lot going on that's actually really relevant. And you probably are more up on it than many. Can you maybe give us a little on that?
Yeah. So basic timeline of what happened is at the end of March, a man named Daniel Prude was killed by the police. His brother called the police to do a mental health arrest / check because he was having a mental, like a psychotic episode, essentially. And the officers arrived, handcuffed him. There's no problem. I guess at one point he started spitting, and so they put a spit hood over his face. And then one of the officers just pretty much did a triangle sit up on his head, while another officer like had his knee in his back, and he stopped breathing. They resuscitated him after a few minutes, but he was brain dead. And then a week later, they took him off life support. And there was a concerted cover up over the past, what, six months it's been since March. The family was told that it was a drug overdose because he did have PCP in his system. And so there was basically the lawyer spent 4-5 months trying to get just the body cam, because all the officers in Rochester, all the police officers in Rochester wear body cams for the most part. So, which I guess makes it a little bit unique compared to some of the other places in the country, in that there was a massive amount of footage and evidence to go along with this. None of it, and there was, it's one
they
of
had their body cams on for a change.
Yeah, they all had their body cams on, and it's interesting because none of the footage, a lot of the footage comes from like outside sources, so all the footage in this case came from police body cams. And so I think there were five different police on the scene. And so there's like five different angles, and you know, all of it with sound. And so you see everything. And so the police department essentially spent months trying to prevent the footage from getting out. The lawyers were doing like a freedom of information request for months. They finally got the footage on August 12th and they released it to the public on September 2nd. And that's when things kind of blew up because it's just an absurd. It was an absurd situation. And like every week it's new revelations that are just super damning. A week ago, I think since the last time we talked, the mayor released a paper, like 300 pages worth of findings that show emails between like the detectives and, or the show the emails between like the police chief and the city's legal counsel that were basically saying, you know, we don't want this to get out. And then, you know, them saying, oh, well, there's a Freedom of Information Act request. And it's like, well, what the attorney general has done in the past is they'll let the lawyer see the footage in the room, but they won't let him, as long as he signs and promises not to like take the footage out or reproduce it in any way. And so it's just like, it's been an insane few months.
And the mayor has been saying that that she was trying to be public with it all along or something. Like this has been kind of her line that she's never been trying to hide anything, so which is really hard to believe.
The mayor claims that she didn't know about it. She claims that the police chief just told her that it was a drug overdose, that a black man had died in police, or that it was a drug overdose, which is hard to believe because the city council, legal counsel knew about it. The communications officer knew about it. And it's mind-boggling to think that she couldn't have known, that she wasn't told in the loop. Because it wasn't, you can see from the emails that the police chief sent to like the city council that they knew exactly what had happened. Like they had seen the video, they knew. And the way that it's framed is they didn't want the video released in the context of everything else that was going on around the country. Because they didn't want, you know, the city to turn into like a protest ground. There was one, they literally said that it doesn't, you know, it won't look very good. Like,
yeah, for some reason.
Yeah, for some reason. And there's no, like in this situation, it was no, and I don't want to say this because I think there's in other places, there's always people, you know, who cast doubt and they're like, oh, well, this didn't happen like that. And the videos are blah, blah, blah. But like this video is start to finish everything. And it's like, you know, every single thing that happened in order with footage, like the way that the police reports were drawn up corroborated it. At one point, one of the police officers took one of took like the form that when they booked him, they tried to spin it. They tried to actively spin it as he was a suspect versus a victim to sort of justify it. It's insane to like the sort of callousness and just disaffection towards human lives that was shown through just like the dialogue in the video, the way that things were handled afterwards, everything.
And then just even the alone, like regardless of who the person is that you have in handcuffs, if you have a spit hood over somebody, and I've never even heard of the existence of spit hoods until this, incident, but you have a spit hood over someone and they're vomiting and you don't take the spit hood off. I mean, you're clearly basically killing them through asphyxiation.
Yeah.
Just obvious.
And that's like the insane. So I guess spit hoods, I mean, I was reading some about this or a few newspapers have posted about it since this whole thing came out. I guess they've become a lot more common since COVID started.
But that's why we've never heard of them. Was it something you had heard of before?
I'd never heard of it, but supposedly it's something that police departments have had for years. It's just, though, I think one of the big things to keep in mind is like it's Rochester in March and this man was naked in the street and even aside from the spit hood, like he held his face into the concrete.
Right.
And that's
instead of giving the guy a blanket or something.
Exactly. And he's like, oh, stop spitting. It's like, well, they had already been in a situation where they had stepped away from him and had him sitting there. Like, you could have easily just stepped away, put on the spit hood and stepped away, or just stepped away. Like, there's so many things that you could have done versus what was done. And it's, and even so the police investigation technically found that they found that they had followed all procedures and that there was no grounds for dismissal or anything. So they've been working. They were working up until like 2 weeks ago.
And you can see how there sometimes in these cases, you can see how the police are maybe even thinking at the time, like, okay, I know what the proper procedures are, and I can argue later that this is according to procedures, you know, when they're abusing somebody.
Exactly.
You do it carefully.
And especially if there's no, like, if nobody else sees the video, if they have kept this video quiet, none of, like, I don't think anybody would have known about this because they spun it as a drug arrest. They didn't even tell the family what actually happened. The family didn't have any suspicions about it until the autopsy came out that said that the death was complications by asphyxiation. Even then, it's just like, what can you do to fight a whole police force?
Yeah, exactly. It's because it's not just bad apples. But are we talking, are there criminal charges, though? Are they looking at criminal charges, or it's just all being considered? Is there a grand jury or anything like in Louisville?
The state AG has actually been investigating it since April. So the state AG picked it up before anybody else did, really. She's convening a grand jury. I think they're looking to either convene by the end of the month or announce findings by the end of the month. And
that in itself kind of says a lot about how the corruption of local politics when it has to be the state attorney general and not a local. It just sounds like from the bottom to the top, it's just been secrecy and corruption in Rochester.
Exactly. And I mean, there is evidence, like at every level, it seems that this has been known about. And it's like you want to be surprised, but you're not surprised.
Yeah, because you know what country you're in, right? And how often this is happening everywhere else, right? So,
and I think one of the unique things about Rochester that's made it a big conversation that focuses specifically on, well, one of the interesting things about Rochester is the police chief, the mayor, most of the city council, a good amount of the county legislature, et cetera, are all all Black people. And so I think in Rochester, the question of power and authority and accountability has become much more salient because it's so easy for people to be like, it's so easy for people to look at situations like Portland, and I hope this doesn't come off the wrong way, or Portland, where there's like most of the people in power are white, and they'll say, well, it's just racism, it's not all of us. But I think that with the situation here, it has really become a conversation about, no, this is police brutality that's racially motivated. It's a system that even when it puts Black people in power, still works to oppress and harass and you know, subjugate us. And I think that that's been, when you've taken one factor out of it, like a big factor out of it, and you still have the same results, that shows that it's much deeper than just putting Black people in office. It's like putting people of color in office and also like dismantling systems such that it's not deeply ingrained in everything going on, you know?
Yeah, because they're still defending a system that is based on the inequalities that exist in the society. And I mean, having spent quite a bit of time in Rochester, I can say that while it's a very diverse society, most of the money is held by, you know, in the form of multi-generational wealth, in the form of houses inherited by mostly white people, and then you have huge amounts of desperate poverty in that city, just as you have all over the country. And I think it's been, but I mean, there's so many peculiarities about any particular place, but Rochester is in one of those situations where it's one of those northern cities that used to have loads of good union jobs for people of all kinds of backgrounds, and then that all fell apart in the course of your lifetime, our lifetimes, basically. It went from when we were kids, it was, I think fair to say it was, there was still a lot of good union jobs. I'm not sure how old you are, but I'm pretty sure you're old enough to maybe as a small child remember the good jobs that used to exist in Rochester. And
Rochester is Kodak and Xerox. So all the Kodak film in the country used to be made in Rochester. All the copier, like all the big innovations that these companies were doing used to be done in Rochester, but Kodak's not really producing film anymore, and they moved all their film production elsewhere. And so it's like, you know, Xerox and Kodak are both now headquartered out of like Palo Alto, you know. And so it's, you have a lot of these factory jobs that were like big, like they would employ the whole city, now have disappeared. And Rochester's is unique in that it's also a majority minority city. And it was, and Kodak and Xerox were really racist until the 60s and 70s, when the local civil rights group Fight really had to push, like the group was called Fight, really had to push Kodak, and especially Kodak, to hire people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, it's all of that is, you know, there's a history of the fighting for this semblance, this level of like, I don't even want to say acceptance, just equality, like for generations now. And then it's like you end up with a majority minority city that's still being, you know, it's still the same power structures exist, right? Somebody doxed a couple of the police officers and posted like four of their addresses. Two of them don't even live in this county,
mm-hmm.
which is insane. But also, why would you have, you know, what? How could you, I don't understand how you can expect somebody to police a group of people that they have no connection with in a city that they're not even from, you know?
And yet it's the norm. I think around here, almost none of the cops live in Portland.
Exactly.
Portland police. And they make enough money to, I mean, Portland's become a very expensive city to live in, but they definitely get paid well enough that they could live in Portland. They just choose to live in some suburb that is more to their liking.
Yeah. So,
Ellie, switching gears here, perhaps a bit. Although maybe, you know, to who knows to what degree we're switching gears, really, because of the subject material that you're often writing about is also very closely related to some of the stuff we're talking about as well. But I was just listening to Son of Slaves, mm-hmm. which is a fantastic track, everything about it. And the music, the way that you are basically, it's like a, I mean, I know it's you know, an oversimplification to maybe for some people, you just come up with a good sort of you know, four bars of beats, and then, you know, freestyle on top of it. I mean, but this is like the opposite end in terms of the amount of production involved. Every new, I mean, it's constantly evolving. The whole musical backdrop in that piece is constant, and other pieces as well. How much time are you spending on the music, and how much, what's the, is does the, do the lyrics come first before you're coming up with these really involved scores? And have you done soundtracks for movies before?
I've never done soundtracks for movies. I just recently, like post this album sort of got me, I did the score for a pilot of a show that's being, so that one's, it's not out yet, but so I just finished that up, actually like sort of at the beginning of quarantine. But so I've always been a really big fan of big scores.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite albums is Symphony in Metallica.
Uh-huh.
And just like the way that sort of, you take this sort of, I don't want to say simple because it is Metallica, but you take this very bass thing where it's like, and then you add in all these extra layers that really elevate the music. And for this album, I had some of the music was, you know, you start off with this sort of evolving thing. And the way that I write, in the way that I sort of do it was, you know, for this album, I had, you know, my beat pad, and I would basically lock each instrument in key so that I, you know, everything was sort of in the same key. And then I would just sit and just listen to it, and then just play a whole bunch of lines and just kind of melodies and stuff. But it's really, I mean, I spent a good amount of time on the music for that, but also I had a lot of people who, you know, who were willing to give feedback and were like, hey, like, you know, at this point, maybe you should drop this out. And so it's like, I usually, I sometimes start with a lyric or an idea. And for this album in particular, I knew that everything was going to sort of revolve around this idea of sort of 19th century Americana, like music stuff, right? So everything kind of comes from these songs that were, that we used to kind of consider what would be, you know, country at the time, like Western, and we turned into sort of choral standards. And so everything was like, okay, it's going to be big. It's going to be the sort of outset was like, well, I want this to be at some point able to be played by a symphony, like an orchestra. And so, like the big thing was like, how do you make these, how do you make a big texture? Like, how do you create something that feels grand and sort of feels, I guess this is it, the whole thing is like a very, is very ethos based. Like, it's how do you capture that big American ethos, right? All the movies that we, that are about America, like you, like even cartoons like Fido, what is that? The movie about the mouse, it's Fido Goes West or something. Or there's a movie where this mouse goes west, like on the Oregon Trail. I can't even think of what it's called, but like the, everything that, that involves like sort of the pioneering and the founding of America is super big and grand. And even the American sort of, what we consider like some of the first American composers. Like I was listening to a lot of McDowell and a lot of Copeland. And so that's like a lot of the influence behind that. And just like making sure that the music is involved, you know, you want to have that variation. You want to have things kind of fly in and out. You want to make it, you know.
So were you building this score around around lyrics that you already had mapped out and entirely? No, is it a process that actually goes hand in hand as you're doing one, the other is kind of changing?
Yeah, for the most part, what happens is I'll just, you know, I'll play around, I'll find some instruments, I'll start building like a song, right? And I'll usually get a bass, maybe 8 bars, like a basic 8 bar structure. And then I'll write lyrics to it, right? I'll write lyrics to it and then figure out, okay, is this song going to be verse, hook? Is it going to be a straight all the way through sort of linear thing? Like what is the song going to do next? So I'll figure out the sort of verses. Then once I've, or how the actual lyrics, then once I figure out most of the lyrics, then I, and even record the lyrics, then I'll go back and start doing the sort of creative stuff on it. And so the creative work comes in and out, dropping the drums, it maybe in and out, right? Adding, you know, changing up a certain part so that the, you know, it's just a cappella over a certain section, or maybe changing up, you know, changing up one of the instruments, or just changing a chord at like on a, at maybe like a third bar every, you know, 12 or 15 or however many bars. Just adding that, all that sort of creative stuff with the echoes and the variation, the changes in sort of effects and all that stuff happens for me once the lyrics are already written. So that, because a lot of it is changes, you know, a lot of it is playing around with the vocals some. And then a lot of it is also playing with the instruments to match the vocals, right?
Mm-hmm.
To accentuate.
And different vocal effects. And then, so you're saying that this 8-bar structure that you come up with in the first place, that is actually, even though you're sometimes, actually quite a lot of the time, you're taking the drum part out completely, but that is still the backdrop. That's still repeat looping, basically?
Yeah, so in some of the songs, so what'll happen is the way that I produce is I do it based on patterns. So I'll have, so basically I'll start with, usually I start with, I'll start with a chord progression, right? And so I'll maybe make 3 or 4 basic chord progressions, and I'll have each of those in a pattern, right? And
is that something that you'll play on a keyboard, like the chord progression?
Yeah, okay. Usually on a keyboard or some kind of like beat pad controller situation. Mm-hmm. So I'll have the chord progressions, and then I'll start building on top of that. But every time I build, I may do one build that, you know, goes C, A, D, G, C, right? And then I'll do another layer that from the same instrument that goes D, C, B, A, whatever, right? And so even though you may have like a basic, maybe one or two core progressions, I've now created four total sort of top lines. And so those are interspersed with each other. So it's, even if it's not, even if it's similar, like patterns, it's the combinations are really what build right there. Right.
Yeah. And
I'll actually usually do two drum kits on a song. A lot of the songs on A Place You Can't Find had toms on them. So, or not toms, I'm sorry, taiko drums. So,
oh, wow.
For cool. example, on the first song, it started with just the drum, and then I had a friend of mine come in and actually play live drums for it. And then there were still some like 808/ taiko drums throughout the, to accentuate it. And that's sort of like how it happens throughout the album, is, and bringing in that second layer of drums also really adds a lot of variation, and sort of playing around with like these sort of, you know, adding in, taking out, and like the addition and subtraction really helps kind of keep the listener's interest peaked, but also just having a lot of patterns where it doesn't feel like things are repeating. And in some songs they aren't. Like in some songs things are consistently shifting. And in some songs it's just a variation of a 4-bar loop. For example, the song Afterlife is the same piano for the entire song, but the verse is much more involved. And then the hook has, my friend Carolyn Shaw did some singing on the hook. So it feels different because the dynamics of the vocals change, and then the vocal effects on the hook are sort of dynamic. And then, you know, vocals are kind of brought in at the end of the second verse. So it feels like it's shifting.
Yeah. And then there's so many points where everything drops out completely, or you just have one instrument or one line back in the vocals up, and that's so powerful. But it must be a struggle to know when minimalism is going to be the most powerful tool. But when you know that you have the option of a wash of all kinds of sounds, and then just choosing not to do that, and also choosing not to do that so often, I think that the minimalism of the track is so much of the power too.
I mean, and minimalism is hard. I sometimes say, like, and this is, I'm a big Kanye West fan, more so before he kind of has dove in off the deep end. And
well, there's the musician and then there's the politics. I mean, right? These things can be separated.
I don't know.
Oh, no. No.
I don't think they can. I'm a person who likes artists not just because of their music, but also who they are. Because when you know who an artist is, and then you also listen to their music, it becomes not just like, when you know an artist is an actual extension of their own music or vice versa, the one or the other supplements them, right? But what you know is that there's a level of authenticity to it. But there's also, it's so much more compelling to listen to artists who, I don't want to say who agree with you, but who know what you know and who can understand you when they say things, right? So for me, Kanye West, and I had a friend ask me this recently, he's like, why have we not sort of canceled Kanye West? And he's like, I don't understand it. And I was like, because it's Kanye. Like, I'm 27. Like, when I remember the first time I heard College Dropout, my parents had bought it for my brother for Christmas. Like, I can still remember how CDs smell when you take the cellophane off it. And like, there was a level of, oh, this is different, but also like, this is important to me. But I think, just using him as just a musical example, Kanye West has spent most of his, I don't want to say most of his career, but every album is more simplistic. I don't want to say simplistic. Every album is a little bit more pulled back in terms of the amount of instrumentation, but it's much more complex. And I think that there's something to be said for the complexity of simplicity, right?
Yeah.
Knowing when enough is too much.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that that's one of the things that I've really been working on, because, like, you know, you get albums that are super powerful and have like a ton of music, but it can feel like too much. Like, it's
totally,
it's so easy to overwhelm someone.
And when you got a budget to work with and a whole lot of musicians at your disposal and a studio and an engineer and a producer, whatever, I mean, well, with the producer, hopefully the, if the producer isn't you, hopefully they're holding you back from these tendencies, but it's just so easy to just be like, wow, let's just do everything. Yeah. I imagine.
And for this one, it was like, because I mean, even now this whole, I would say 3/4 of the instruments on this album are digital. So it's basically me sitting in a room. I wrote this while I was doing at McDowell Colony. And so it's me sitting in a room, essentially trying to not go overboard. And I had a lot of friends, like my friend Chris and my friend Mike, who are musicians that I work with also. They were, you know, they gave me good feedback on like, hey, this is way too much. And so, you know, there are points where I'd have to take that feedback and sit down and listen to it and be like, yeah, let me pull back some here. There are whole instruments that are left off. You know, I have whole synth lines that I've left off certain songs, parts where I've just like had to cut, like taken an instrument and just like made it so, like super quiet, because it's like you want to give people some, I don't want to say digestible, but you want to give people something that they're willing to listen to.
Yeah. That's, that doesn't get sort of repetitive in a way that's like, okay, I understand how this is. It's like every time, every few seconds, it's like, oh, this is bringing me to a new place.
Yeah. Exactly.
When I know, so looking at your website, I see what I see when I look at so many other artists' websites during the pandemic in the upcoming gigs section. It's a big fat, like, no,
exactly.
No, yeah, nothing. You know? But before the pandemic, when things were a little, I mean, the other thing is, like, you know, we're talking about, there's the pandemic, which has, of course, destroyed so many people's livelihoods, either temporarily or permanently, and that is very much the case with all kinds of artists, musicians, and of course for so many musicians, their day jobs, if they had day jobs or day jobs, were also in an industry that's been devastated. So but prior to the pandemic, you know, as any working musician or person who's been attempting to be a working musician knows, we are in an industry overall, if you want to, you know, just broadly call it from the rich to the poor, from every genre, you know, if you call the music industry an industry, which in a way it really is a global industry, in the sense that at all levels of, you know, the biggest corporations to the, you know, pretty much the smallest independent artist, we were all recording albums, putting out CDs and trying to sell them. And, you know, some people had much greater avenues for doing that than others, but still it was like a consistent thing. And it's in some sense, and it's all shrunk by more than 80% in the past 20 years, as you know, and most musicians are keenly aware of this fact. But like, in you say you're 27, so you actually have never been you know, so you were a small child back when the music industry was five times the size that it is now. And but you moved to Austin because it was a better place to try to pursue a career in this shrunken down music industry. And I just wonder if you could reflect on what that's been like in terms of trying to be a working musician in this period of time.
Austin is such a weird place, because it's like, it sort of builds itself as like, oh, you know, we're the live music capital of the country, which is a lot of musicians know now, like live music is pretty much how you make your money. Like, you know, nobody makes money off streaming, make money off touring and selling merchandise. Like, that's just how it is. And Austin is great because it's, Austin is very, I don't want to say protective of its cultural legacy, but Austin has an understanding like, oh, like we need to do right by certain people. And so, you know, there are, and that's not like an official thing. That's just like the general culture of the city. So like, I'm blessed because there are nonprofits that I can look to that, like I get low cost mental health services. I get, My health insurance is paid for by a nonprofit. So I'm blessed in that regard. And I'm blessed because I'm around all these musicians who I'm learning all this stuff from that I didn't even know about before I moved to Austin. Like, I like see these things and I'm like, what is this? I was like, why does everybody else know about this, but I have no idea about it, you know?
What's an example?
For example, I never like thought about doing like an instrumental beat show before I moved to Austin. And then I got really big into like synthesizers and stuff and like sort of more electronic music. And so like my next project is going to be much more sort of synth based and sort of, I don't want to say it will be more minimal, but it'll be like a lot more synth based and a little bit and a lot more sort of experimental, and playing around with different sounds. But just like, and Austin has given me the opportunity and the people who are really open to like teaching and like being just, I don't want to say mentors, but just being friends who are willing to impart knowledge.
And there are still a lot of musicians in Austin, because I mean, the place has been so rapidly gentrified. It's probably twice as expensive to live there now as it was 10 years ago.
Exactly. But
there are musicians holding on, or are they moving out to the exurbs? And
I think a lot of musicians are moving out to the exurbs, but people are still playing. I think that this pandemic is going to do a lot of damage to the music scene. I think in Austin, the only people that are going to win this pandemic are tech people, because they're going to be fine and they're still going to be have a lot of money. And then developers who are going to be able to pick up like all these closing venues and stuff. They're going to pick up the land and they're going to build expensive condos right downtown. And I think that musicians are going to be struggling a lot after this. But I also, like, I have my own, I mean, Austin's not a perfect city by any means. Like, I think the music scene has a lot of racism ingrained in it. So like Austin musicians tend to look down, and this is all musicians, but they tend to look down on like hip hop artists, and they sort of don't see it as music. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason I sort of had to pivot to do like more beat shows and more like DJing gigs, because when it comes to a city like Austin, like people, like Austin has become so gentrified that like most of it's like a very white city. Mm-hmm. And a lot of white people don't like to engage with black culture unless it's on their own terms.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been difficult, because you end up with a community that's essentially a black art form that's being gatekept by like almost exclusively by white people, which is,
such a long history to that particular phenomenon, huh?
Exactly. Like I'm basically like begging white people to get on hip hop shows, which is
bizarre.
That's what it was, and I refused. I've like reached the point where I was like, I'm not doing this. So, like, you know, we throw our own shows. I will put on show. If it weren't for the pandemic, I would be doing a monthly show at a like this community art space called Kenny Durham's Backyard. And they're really great, and they're actually currently fighting right now to get funding from the city to build a large, like large black art center in East Austin as sort of combat gentrification and to make sure that like the black cultural heritage of Austin is kept intact.
After everybody's forced to move out of town because they can't pay the rent, there'll be left over a black cultural center in the middle of this gentrified neighborhood.
Exactly. And it's unfortunate, because like, I think, you know, black people are way more open to like engaging with seeing black people as like, oh, they sing the blues and they do like rock and roll. Like, but they don't necessarily want to deal with protest music, or that shows black people as having a certain autonomy and agency that oh, you still there, David?
Yeah, still here.
Okay. Yeah. They
like
don't
autonomy, like having a three dimensionality, huh? But yeah, like being involved with different genres, not being able to put into a box, right? Exactly. I mean, that's
and like even I think that what scares a lot of people about hip hop is like black aggression, right?
Mm.
Blues is
sort of a subversion of black aggression in a way, like a
blues feels like the aftermath of struggle to a lot of people. I know that's not what it is, but a lot of people see it as like, oh, this person is sad. And James Baldwin talks about this, how James Baldwin has a quote where it's like because of the protective sentimentality that protects white people from its actual meaning. Music is the only way that the Negro in America can tell their story, right? Mm. So people like blues because it's something that they can see, they can feel like, oh, I'm part of this because it's sad. Even though just being sad is a very non-sensual way to, like a very emotionally removed way to look at something, like, oh, it's sad music. people like rock and roll because you can put, you can think a black face onto a rock and roll artist, as terrible as that sounds, right? You can do it. You can't run from race in hip hop. It's so much more in your face. And also, like, it's this level of, there's this level of white acceptance when it comes to artists that they don't, that remind them of this other side of life that they've been trying to avoid, that they just don't want to engage with. I mean, that's why everybody, and it's like that they're not, if it challenges your worldview, you don't want to deal with it and you make excuses not to deal with it, right? Everybody wants to talk, everybody loves Tribe Called Quest, right? And they call it conscious rap, and they do that in you know, I guess in juxtaposition to some of the more aggressive rap, I guess aggressive. I hate the dichotomy between like gangster rap and conscious rap. I think it's terrible, right?
Right. I don't understand the dichotomy because I mean I guess I don't know which category Tupac Shakur would be put in, but when I hear Tupac Shakur, I hear eloquent commentary on life in America. And I mean, if anybody is calling this gangsterism in any sense, it's a preposterous accusation.
And that's like, and even I mean, if you think about, so for example, Tribe Called Quest has always been held up as, oh, the conscious rap, which is an insane thing to say, because what you're trying to say is, oh, their lyrics are less, you know, people want to pretend it's like, oh, they're less sexually charged or they're less, you know, violent, all this stuff. But the reason that that's, I mean, you can say anything over a jazz sample and people can just say, oh, it's jazz, so it's still art, right? But if you think about it, Tribe Called Quest Scenario, which is like, you know, one of their biggest songs, came out in 1991, which is 2 years after, what is that, 89 was when Fear of a Black Planet by Public Enemy came out.
No, it's only, about right, yeah.
88 is when Straight Outta Compton came out, I believe. Like, so it's in, and then 92 is when, 91 is also when Fear of Dog came out, if I recall. And so you have this thing where it's like, oh, well, they're conscious, but it's like, you're not, all the things that you're claiming don't exist in the music actually do. You're just overlooking it because this is more palatable to white sensibilities, which, and like, so it's like people are like, oh, well, they're not as misogynistic. And it's like, there's a line where somebody says, bust a nut inside your eye to show you where I come from. And it's just like that. Like, I don't, it's not a matter of, I'm not passing judgment, but what I'm saying is like, to make a dichotomy based off something that doesn't exist, there has to be some other deeper reasoning to be doing it. And it's because it's more calm. Like, it's more like, oh, we're going to bop our heads. You can't listen to Fuck the Police and still have willful ignorance. Right.
Right.
You can't.
It's too clear. The message exactly. is like, clear.
You can't feign like, oh, I didn't know this was going on, when you listen to Little Ghetto Boy by, you know, Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg. Like, everybody talks about The Chronic, everybody loves, you know, F with Dre Day and all this stuff, but no, you never hear anybody talking about like Little Ghetto Boy, right? Like, it, and that's like one of the best songs on that. That's like one of the most salient songs on that album. But it's like, there's this level of willful ignorance that people like, and people want this sort of respectability out of hip hop. And that's why you don't see, that's why I think a lot of hip hop doesn't necessarily exist in Austin in the way that it does in Houston or Dallas, because Austin has the ability to just not acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. They can just say, oh, it's all, we have all this other type of music, or, oh, well, we have, you know, hip hop artists do this when they come here, so we don't like to book them. But that's insane, you know?
Were you getting to Houston or Dallas or other cities or touring much prior to the pandemic? One of the things that I was listening to on your website. I think it was a sort of a video preview about an upcoming album where you were saying how you're growing up in America with black skin but with a blue passport.
Exactly.
And I was wondering also, having done a lot of traveling around the world myself. Different societies are so different, even though there's a lot of consistencies as well. Exactly. But I wonder what your experience has been with touring and with leaving this country. You've done much of that.
I haven't done much touring. I have left America a lot. So I've
been tell me about that.
I've been to China twice. I've been to the South Pacific. I've been to I went to France and Barcelona when I was younger. I went to Italy when I was in high school. So I've seen a lot of the world, and just everything feels so different.
That's a wide variety of places.
But I think that there is, you know, in every culture there is, I think every culture has a person who is subjugated. Every culture has a somebody who's looked at as lesser than, or whose culture is trying to, who somebody, you know, has spent time trying to eradicate a culture, from Aboriginal people in Australia and like the Maori in New Zealand to the Uyghurs in China, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, coming from a context where I don't want to say I'm always looking for it, but where I understand that no history is as straightforward as people expect, like, make it out to be, you see a lot of that, like, and you understand, okay, this is a thing that, like, you have this culture that's celebrated, and as a tourist, I'm supposed to see it and engage with that and be like, oh, this is great. But also I know that nothing comes free.
And you coming from somewhere else, you kind of can see these dynamics in I think a lot more quickly than the locals, right? Exactly. Like you go to a place for a few days, you're like, oh, okay, I see. You're talking to that guy that way because he's a Uyghur. I get it. You know, this is, exactly. They don't even see what they're doing. Yeah.
And also, like, but you also at the same time, as somebody who's not accepted in your own country, have to answer for the sins of America abroad. I had a woman. The first time I went to China, I had a woman, she's like, how come America sees Taiwan as a separate country? Which was, I guess, you know, at the time, I was like, I didn't know how to answer that, right?
Right. I'm not America. Why are you asking me?
I was essentially there on, like, scholarships, like, just studying. Like, this is back in high school. And I was just like, it's like one of those questions where you don't know, but also, like, you're just like, I know I should be able to speak about this, but I don't, like, I can't answer, you know, I, like, the correct answer is, like, you know, because American interests, because America can better sway Taiwan than it can China, but there's also all these other factors that go into it, right?
And like the very question itself, like, even just the phrasing of the question is such a question in itself. Like, why would she be asking you to represent America? And why does she think that you might? And it sounds like she identifies with China as herself. I mean, just the phrasing of the question, it tells you quite a lot about her mindset.
Exactly. And then it's also just like, you know, every place has their own. It's interesting to see every place's conception of Americans. When I went to the South Pacific, we went to, like, a middle school in New Zealand, you know, and it's mainly, you know, white Kiwis. And so we're talking, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm from Rochester, New York. I'm like, oh, you're from New York? Do you know Ja Rule? And, like, that's, like, they're like, do you know 50 Cent? And, like, that's an inch, like, that just shows you how being an American, but also, like, being a Black American, you're seen as sort of this other thing. Like, there's this level of, like, Black cool and, like, you know, the rappers and stuff. Like, that's the whole image they get. But, like, that level of I'm from a city and a place where I'm consistently looked down upon, it's lost because there's a lot of historical context that doesn't go along with those flashy music videos, because that's just not how we present things in America. Like, you could play a Public Enemy song, you'll play Fuck the Police, but they won't follow it up with, okay, and here's some images of the Rampart Division, like, breaking down an innocent woman's home and, like, beating the shit out of their kids.
Yep.
And so that, I think that, like, there is a certain level of, like, to be Black is to live as a context in a contextless world, if that makes sense. Like, to be Black is to live constantly explaining context to counteract the conceptions that people already have of you. And so it's just, there's just so much, especially when you travel abroad, it's just like, there's so many layers of
extra layers of context that you're trying to. Yeah, interesting. But then when you're, but then to, I mean, is it also like, yeah, I guess that's, I guess it's more when you're coming from the United States to another country that's maybe less well known globally than the United States is, then that, that phenomenon could be a bit different, right? Where you, where, you know, you're kind of more freshly observing dynamics in a society that's not already famous, right? And whereas you're coming from the United States, you're a black man coming from the United States from New York. And so they already have all these ideas about who you must be. It's different from a Kiwi coming to New York. Where is New Zealand?
And I think that there's also this level of like the way that America presents black people is either there's no in between as like being a regular black person, quote unquote.
Right.
Like the images of black people are either like images of black exceptionalism, like images of black people as like the bastion of American exceptionalism. So you get your, you know, your athletes, you get your performing artists, all that stuff, or as the sort of bastion of criminality. Like you'll never go and see, you know, Jonathan who lives down the street. Like you'll never see an image of they don't show episodes of Girlfriends in France, right? There's no Spanish translation of In Living Color or, you know, Living Single or any of those shows like being put on Netflix and other places. Like that, so there is this like large context of like the that sort of seats this minority of either of the minority of extremes as
the
majority. And so you go places and people are like, oh, you must be either famous or a criminal. And it's like, well, I just like to read books and, you know, drink water like everybody else.
Right. But you have these two options. Exactly. And you need to fit into this.
It's like, well, wait, you don't rap or run a ball or sell drugs. And then you're like, no. And they're like, well, what could you possibly do beside those things? And you're just like, I don't like, I like turkey sandwiches.
Right.
Well, they're delicious. So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Ellie, do you have any, I mean, this is, it's a horrible question, but I ask it of everyone. Do you have any predictions for what might be happening in this country and in Rochester over the next, say, few weeks?
Let's see, with the Breonna Taylor verdict coming out,
And I'm just broadly anything. I'm not specifically talking about, you know, the police brutality, but definitely including police brutality and the whole everything. Just any broad predictions of any kind.
Bills are going to win the Super Bowl. Sabres are going to win the Stanley Cup.
Excellent. I've never bet on sports before, but I think I'm going to start right now.
Florida's going to fall into the sea. Everybody's gonna live except Tom Brady. Predictions. I don't know what happens next. I think that in the next 3 years, every politician in every major city that's been going through these types of changes is gonna get voted out.
And who's gonna get voted in? I mean, is there anybody to vote in who's going to be representing a different kind of politics, or do you think that they'll just burn down the state houses?
I think younger activists who are much more, who their values are much more group consensus based, right? Or at least there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be forced to run because you don't want people in power who want to be in power. That's the whole thing about that's the paradox of authority. The people who should be in power don't want to be in power. Because they know that people who want power shouldn't be in power. But they also understand that they could make a change, but they still don't want it, right? I think that there's going to be a big push for, in these sort of cities that are seen as progressive, I think there's going to be a much bigger push by younger people. I think, you know, in smaller cities like this, like Rochester is definitely going to I think every elected official in Rochester is probably going to be replaced in the next 6 years. I think that we're at a moment where either one of two things could happen. We could give in to authoritarianism and we can let it overtake us, or we can take a step back and say, oh, actually, like, we need to do something different. Like, nothing, this isn't working for any of us.
For any of us, right? Isn't that it? I mean, when you talk about, you were talking about the developers and how they're going to be the ones benefiting, buying everything up. And mm-hmm. But in the meantime,
even a larger thing of just like on a government level, like poor people vote for Trump. Like, that's what it comes down to. Rich people, poor people vote for Trump. Rich people, poor people vote for Democrats. But we still don't have fair priced, like, healthcare. We still work a crazy amount of hours in what's supposed to be the most developed country in the world. Like, we still
two jobs just in order to pay for rent and health. And then now that's even, I mean, we're looking at it such a crisis now with tens of millions of people facing eviction. And I mean, I wonder, do you get the sense among just people around you that there's a sort of a consciousness of how capitalism is just not working for the vast majority of people? I mean, like, more people seem to be kind of coming to the sudden realization that this is totally fucked.
I think that you're getting a lot more of that. But I think that a lot of it is showing up without nuance, which is, I think there's a lot of like, don't vote. But I think that can be a bit accelerationist. I think that there's, but I understand, like, I know that there's gotta be a better way. This can't be life. Like, I wake up every day and I look around and I'm like, this can't be it for us. Like, just Americans, like, this doesn't, we have entered into a system that's completely against what the founding fathers wanted. Literally, like, you know, whatever they were doing in their lives, slave owners, just their ideology around American, about like the American political structure, like, it wasn't supposed to be the way that it is. Two-party systems were never supposed to be a thing. Like, monetary influence, like, it's all these things, like, that would really make us the country that we're supposed to be, we've just ignored. Like, we've essentially set up a system where we talk bad about everything that could benefit people. We call it socialist. We call it, you know, communist. Like, that's a buzzword. It's like, it's okay to give people healthcare.
People outside of the United States are so confused by this whole phenomenon. Like, why don't they want healthcare? What is it that they don't like about healthcare?
It's like it's okay to give people healthcare. Like, it's okay to, like, give people, like, a universal basic income. Like, it's okay to
survive.
It's okay to want people to be okay. Like, and I think there's this thing, it's like, well, they don't work hard, so they shouldn't be able to get this. And it's just like, so we've so intrinsically tied a person's value, not to who they are as a person, but the value of their labor.
And in a society where increasingly everything's automated and jobs are outsourced, and yet this mentality persists, and people yell at me to get a job whenever I'm going out postering, you know, like, what makes you think I'm unemployed, you know, just because I'm putting posters on a telephone pole?
Anytime that you care for somebody else, it's like, get a job. And you're just like, no, I don't know why you think that me protesting and me having a job are
somehow mutually exclusive.
Like, for a lot of people, like, protesting, like, there's a reason that protests don't start at 11 a.m., that they start at 6 or 7 p.m.
Right?
There's a reason that protests happen at night, because people have to leave work and go home and shower and stop thinking about how much they hate their boss so they can think about how much they hate the politicians. They have to pivot. They have to pivot their aggression from the person who financially exploits them to the people who are politically exploiting them. Like, you have to, like, it's just
so well put.
It's just, you know, and I think that there's this the level of it just blows my mind how callous we've become as a people for the pursuit of what? More money? Like, for the pursuit of billions, what does one person need $1 billion for? Like, I guess if you're going to buy a yacht, but yachts, what? It costs $500 million? So that means you still have another $500 million to enjoy the yacht. Like, what do you need another billion for?
And what's going to happen when the whole society collapses and you have your $500 billion? Then what?
Exactly. Like, what do you, people with 27 bedroom houses? Why do you need 27 bedrooms? You have 27 grandmas. Like, what? Mm. So yeah.
Ellie, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for joining me for the hour.
No worries. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you. I don't know what comments might have been coming in because comments aren't working anymore, but we can see them later. I suspect other people were also enjoying the conversation, but we'll find out later. But thank you so much.
No problem. Have a good afternoon.
Yeah, you too. See you again. And thanks for everybody for tuning into this discussion with Ellie Arbour, fantastic hip-hop artist and a multi-talented person from Rochester via Austin or Austin via Rochester. And I will be back on live streaming tomorrow from Big Red Studio for the afternoon. And on Sunday at 1 p.m. Pacific, I'll be doing a little show here on the internet and then more interviews with other interesting people on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday coming up this coming week. Thanks for listening. Remember, don't pay the rent. Don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye.